right, all right, all right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. Yeah, back again. That's right, all right. And we got a very interesting show today. I think you're going to really like it. At the back end of the show, we're going to be listening to a special segment from the dialogue between Cornel West and Bob Avakian, Revolution and Religion, The Fight for Emancipation, and The Role of Religion. We're going to be listening to a part about what if. What if the world could be a whole different way than it is right now, all right? And it's something I find very compelling and moving and something very appropriate for today. And before that, we're going to have something very special, actually. I'm going to go back to something that I recorded last year around this time when I brought Keith David, the actor Keith David, a very prominent theater and television and movie actor. And he came in hot off of playing Paul Robeson on stage and getting ready to go into playing Frederick Douglass in the film. And he came in to join us and read the statement from Frederick Douglass, his speech entitled, What to the Slave is Your 4th of July? So that's really a mind blower. All right. So stick around to hear that. Definitely don't miss that. But opening the show up, I'm very pleased to be bringing you an interview I did with Gene Carlomusto, who's the director of Larry Kramer in Love and Anger. And it's a portrait of one of the most important and controversial figures in contemporary gay America. Carlomusto is the producer, director, and editor who has produced documentaries and independent films for over 30 years. I got the chance to interview her up at Sundance Film Festival this year, and we're going to just jump right into the interview now. So take it away, Federico. Gene, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Let's jump into this. First, I want you to give people a synopsis of your film, Larry Kramer in Love and Anger.
Larry Kramer in Love and Anger is a portrait of a very complicated man who was influential to so many of us who were active in the AIDS activist movement. Larry was the provocateur. Larry was the one who told us we needed to get out and fight, because without doing that, we were not going to find any kind of cure for what was then, and is now really, a very serious plague.
But your film, there's a lot about him in relation to AIDS, but it also deals with him as a person before and beyond AIDS. And I think it's really, really important that people understand that, because to me, it gave me a picture of, I mean, you know, everybody who's seen Normal Heart sort of has this image of Larry Kramer, you know, and if you knew anything about ACT UP and how it started, you have this image of Larry Kramer. But you added a dimension to him that I think a lot of people just don't know.
I really think that Larry is complex, and to me, that's where the real heart of the matter is. And if you look at Larry, if you look at him as a very shy child who was different and who was into things his father called sissy things, and how he had to fight to be who he is, if you look at that, you get more of a rounded portrait of Larry. You also get to see the complete family picture that molded him. There was his mother, who was very active during World War II in the Red Cross. She was organizing blood drives. Larry was on those blood drives. She was going and visiting war widows and trying to get them funds so that they could feed their children. So Larry had this very formative family. The mother, who was a social crusader, the father, who was a curmudgeon who couldn't stand the fact that his son was effeminate. And then there was his older brother, who really just loved him and tried to support him and tried to understand as best he could, as a straight man of that time, how to help his younger brother, how to get him into Yale, how to get him back on his feet when he tried to commit suicide at Yale. Arthur was the one who really helped Larry stay alive until his adulthood.
When you were talking about that, when you're talking about his experience at Yale and all that, there's this whole path that he took, including, I found it very interesting, for somebody who's like a hellraiser to a certain extent, he's shy and dealing with a lot of very heavy questions for a young person to be dealing with anyway,
right.
But then all this other stuff on top of his familial relations and whatnot, and the society in general. Here he is, he knows that he is different in terms of his sexuality, but he also knows he's not different in terms of being a human being, which is very important. When I was watching the film, I thought one of the things that came through as an undercurrent was sort of that idea of the baseline thing of, look, I'm a human being, but then you have to deal with this. You have to wrestle with how the rest of society is looking with what you see as part of your own humanness in terms of this, your sexuality. So I wanted to talk about that a little, because it's interesting the way he dealt with that too. Here, everybody's talking about the 60s in the U.S. and changing their life. And he went to London and it changed his life. And I thought that was really interesting.
I think for Larry, that human aspect that you're talking about, it was important for him to connect with that because everything else told him he was not worth very much, that he was a sissy and somehow less of a man. So I think going off to London, going into intense psychotherapy every day, it was so cheap in those days. He said he was literally going to an analyst every day. And seeing that he was actually really good in the movie business. He worked on some of the best pictures that came out of the British film renaissance in the 60s. I think that gave him a sense of place. And when he finally was able to connect with writing, that's when he really connected to his heart, because at heart, Larry Kramer is a writer. And so once he got over his own inner block about writing and wrote the screenplay for Women in Love and got an Academy Award nomination out of it, all of a sudden, it was, I think, something that gave him a sense of self-worth and a feeling of confidence that he brought back. He actually ascended to a very high place in the movie industry. Not many people get nominated for an Academy Award. And if you look at Women in Love today, the film is still quite interesting and very daring. You know, in the film, you see that wrestling scene and it's full frontal nudity. Yes. And I said to him, Larry, how did you get that? And it was very much tied to the fact that this came out of a high work of literature. And he could appeal to the censors and say, this is true to the book. And that's how we were able to get such a revealing scene, mm-hmm. powerful scene. But it wasn't that that confidence wasn't tested. The movie business chews up confidence like snow before a snowblower. I mean, he really had to reckon with whatever the movie industry offered after he then wrote a screenplay for a bomb, Lost Horizon.
As he goes on, he comes back, he goes on, and there is this point about Larry being just a ball, a tightly wound ball of contradiction. He comes home and he's taken up life openly as a gay man, yet he then alienates this whole segment of the gay community, the male gay community in particular, with his book Faggots and with his stand around casual sex and how much does that define you and what are we doing here and all this stuff. On that end, he has that. And then a little later, he has this very radical position in relation to people have got to step out and basically say, look, we're gay and we're proud. And we're not going to be shoved into the meat grinder.
Right. Well, you know, if you look at Faggots as a book, as a statement on gay life at that time, you can see Larry trying to figure out why this relationship with this man who he truly fell in love with, this character Dinky, who is based on his real life husband at this point, David Webster, Larry is trying to get out the anger that this relationship could never become something solid and stable at the time because people weren't settling down. People were in this very free lifestyle. You know, it had a lot of promiscuity, it had a lot of drugs, a lot of closeted major figures are in that book. And so there's the anger that this relationship couldn't be, but there's also a wonderful satirical look at the scene at that point. And it's very funny. The book is funny as well. But Larry did what you really weren't supposed to do at that point, which was he told the secrets. He really gave a very accurate portrait of what was really happening. And it was, Eric Sawyer in the film calls it the Sexual Olympics. It's beyond. I mean, it's really intense if you go through Faggots. But Larry doesn't flinch. He put it out there tooth and nail. And when it came out, and everybody skewered it, everybody hated it, he stood his ground. But, you know, there are two sides to that story as well. There is Larry wondering why we can't just settle down. But there was also a very young gay movement at the time that fought very hard to have a liberated sense of sexuality. So it led to setting the stage to what would become the beginning of the AIDS epidemic and the very complicated politics that infused that period of time.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Giancarlo Musto, the director of the film Larry Kramer in Love and Anger, which is currently running on HBO.
Talk about the complicated politics right after that, or right in the midst of Larry's thing in the wake of faggots and the whole dealing with and wrestling with, okay, sexual liberation in terms of what you're doing and being proud of it and out and in the open. And again, I think it comes back to this, what seemed to me to be a central contradiction for Larry Kramer was that point about the life you're forced to live in a country like this, in a society like this in general, and the basic conflict that has with recognizing people's humanity. You know, all kinds of people, but particularly gay people. I mean, that was a big thing because even, you know, he goes in the midst of all the stuff he's doing around in the aftermath of faggots, he's also then confronted with this AIDS crisis. And he very clearly from the very beginning, he's not just saying this is terrible, it's just a disease we have to deal with. He's tied it to what he sees as an attempt by the society in general to erase the humanity of gay people.
He is very much involved with trying to create a history, a strong foundation of self-worth in what he would call his people, the LGBT populations out there. And so I think Larry just feels a call to make sure that history remembers us. He wrote this great essay at one point called We Are Not Crumbs. And this all along has been Larry's pushing us to say, don't take second-class citizenship because you're gay. You need to understand that you have value. Nowadays, we're in a different place. We're talking about marriage equality. But one of the reasons I made this film was because I wanted people to go back just 20 years ago and see that we were nowhere near marriage equality. People were still massively in the closet at the beginning of the AIDS crisis. And one of the things that Larry pushed us on is saying, oh no, the closet is not a place that you can hide in anymore. If you really want to create change, you have to come out. And we should also not let people who are in high positions who are closeted oppress us because it's super dangerous. And this was the fundamental problem that he had with Mayor Koch at the time, was because he felt Koch wasn't paying enough attention because he really didn't want that side of his life out in public.
You know, it's interesting, too, because when you're saying this, I'm thinking, like, even now when you're talking about the difference between the times, and actually, you got to be very careful because, I mean, look, there's a fight over the right for gay people to marry. There's a fight over that, and it's real. And the assault that's coming down on gay marriage right now.
Yeah.
Again, you know, it's not a settled question. Really.
And not by any means. In fact, we'll see a lot coming down the pike very shortly in terms of how things are going to go. It's going to be a very interesting political time.
Yeah, and it raises the question of what needs to be done in the face of this in terms of the social movements, because I thought that was one thing that you brought out in your film that Larry really got a grip on and had an understanding of when he talked about the fact that AIDS created a community and it did it in a couple of different ways. And there's a point of that kind of community, on one level, that kind of community needed again now in a way that it's not there.
Yeah. George Wolfe says in the film that AIDS created a community, and a community that was set on taking care of each other and on fighting. And it really did, because the first response with GMHC, Gay Men's Health Crisis, and Larry was co-founder of Gay Men's Health Crisis. So at the time, it was something they pulled together very quickly because all their friends were sick and dying, and nothing was being done. So this was the beginning, but the political component was yet to come, because what was to happen is there would be years of no response. And by that time, by 1986, 87, the anger was just overflowing and it was ready to be tapped. And that's when Larry really had his moment, because he was able to inspire, get people in a room, give one of his fiery speeches where he said, I want half this room to stand up. And he said, you're all going to be dead if we don't do something.
It's very heavy, too, because you make a point in the film. You use photos of gay men who have AIDS and towards the final stages of it. And they really look like concentration camp photos from the Nazis in World War II. And I kept looking at that and I kept thinking, you know, I'm watching your film. I didn't realize how heavy the situation facing men who had AIDS was. I mean, the way when you bring out in the film that people were left to lay in their waste and that no one would treat them, that there was nothing there. And then you have this voice come out like hellfire and brimstone, righteously angry, but it was up against a situation that was really intensely oppressive and dangerous. And
yes, well, this is one of the reasons that Larry had a problem with the New York Times, because people didn't know that this was happening because it wasn't being reported on. And if you look at the whole situation with an epidemic, for instance, today around Ebola, you know, we had just a couple of cases in this country, and it was top story for days, for weeks. AIDS, we had 40 cases in 1981. There was one article, there were years where it was buried on page 16, page 32. So it's not surprising that so many people who weren't directly involved with the community's hardest hit didn't know a lot about it. And as someone who sort of came out of a background of the left myself, but also as someone who's a lesbian, you know, one of the chants that we took to us to Washington in 1987 was 30,000 dead from AIDS. Where was the left? You know, the left really didn't pick up on this either, because not necessarily a connection between Absolutely. The left and acceptance of homophobia. There was also a macho aspect of the left. So we really did not feel incredibly connected to leftist movements.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Gene Carlo Musto, the director of the film Larry Kramer in Love and Anger, which is currently running on HBO.
Yeah, and it's very interesting that when you brought up that in relation to Ebola. With Ebola, there was a, you know, the society in general and the rulers in particular had this agenda of sort of get everybody concentrated on not here, it's not going to happen to us here, we're not going to get infected. Meanwhile, thousands and thousands and thousands of people in Africa are dying and nothing is being done, and the main focus becomes what's going to happen to us. And in a sense, when AIDS was spoken about back then, first of all, it was mainly buried, because this was a people that the system just get rid of them. I mean, that was what was happening, and that was basically pretty much what the whole culture is around. It's an assault on the culture, on American culture of like He-Man, you know, all this mm-hmm. stuff, right? Mm-hmm. But you also have this thing of, remember, there was such a terrible stigma. That's the point you bring out about the people laying in waste in hospitals. This wasn't in their own homes and nobody coming to take care. It was in hospitals. They couldn't get care. Even it stretched to, and you know, remember, what was that little kid's name? Brian White. And there was pogromish stuff being built up. And in that context, Larry stepping out like he did was just remarkable and really imperative that it happened like that. It was just one of those things, one of those moments where somebody says, no, I won't live like this and I won't die like this.
I also want to say that Larry stepped out. Larry had a lot of resources because he was a powerful guy in the film industry, but he was also able to collaborate with other groups like the Lavender Hill Mob and other gay activists at the time who were just starting to do actions. And one of the great organizing things that he pulled together in that presentation that ACT UP would grow out of, he just managed to invite all the right people in that room and just set the stage for something new to develop. So Larry's a catalyst, but I also, in making this film, I really want to make it clear that it doesn't have to be Larry. This quality of really fighting hard, bringing people together, really fighting hard, it's present in everyone. I think Larry's a great example, and that's why I like to hold him up. But the other thing you see in the film is you see Larry's now a guy, he's approaching 80, and we're not going to have him forever. So it's important to look at his example and understand that what is possible, and that you don't have to compromise what you really feel strongly about, because Larry didn't. People disagreed with him, but he managed to pretty much stay true to what he felt was important.
In terms of the importance of ACT UP, when you were talking about gay people and people who were working with gay people or had some recognition of what was going on politically and ideologically in relationship to what was happening with AIDS, there was a point where the importance of ACT UP, ACT UP really broke through a wall in a way that was so important and was instructive for people on the left, but for people in the society in general. And Larry always pushed it, like the opening scene of the film where he's going, plague, you know, and he's making it clear. And if you have a plague, You have a certain response that's necessitated. And I thought that with the formation of ACT UP, that was something that was, I mean, historically, it proved to be very, very important.
It did. And I think a fundamental word in thinking about Larry is responsibility. And ACT UP was all about everyone taking personal responsibility for finding solutions to this pandemic. So everyone, and many of us in ACT UP, Larry and Maxine Wolf, who's also in the film, they were two of our elder statespeople, but many of us were in our 20s, and we were underemployed artists. And so ACT UP brought us all together, and incredible art came out of ACT UP. You had the graphics of Grand Fury. You had graphics of other groups doing work in ACT UP. The graphics are so potent. And that was one thing I have to say is when we went down to Occupy, the Occupy movement, we were all looking at the signage and saying, guys, get it together. You know, people are there with magic marker signs and everything. And, you know, we came out with that incredible silence equals death graphic and just tons. And then there was the part I was engaged in with my comrades who were all doing video. And we broke down barriers. I shot the first ACT UP demo. I met some other crews. Their camera malfunctioned. So I said, here, you can share my footage. People were always doing that. There wasn't this intense sense of ownership and copyright at the time. We were sharing footage because the object was to amplify the movement. And that was exhilarating. When it starts to get a little bit heartbreaking is later on in time when all these collectives and different groups are trying to figure out who could use this footage. It became a little bit tricky. But at this point in time, I think we're basically still invested in the idea that this footage is part of our history. People should see it. People should use it to tell the story of this time. And this time shouldn't be forgotten because it was truly both an incredible moment for activism in this country and in all the other ground zeros all over the world who also organized to fight back to get treatment. But it was also the worst of time because we saw, for myself, I had all this footage of my friends and we really felt that we were going to get a cure. We're out there. We really felt that maybe in a couple of years this would be over. Mm-hmm. And when I look back at this footage, a couple of years later, I was watching my friends get sick. I could see them go from healthy, still with some baby fat on them, to people who looked like they were in their 80s, mm-hmm. in their 20s.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Gene Carlo Musto, the director of the film Larry Kramer in Love and Anger, which is currently running on HBO.
There's something there that in the beginning of the film, somebody says that the world changed because of Larry Kramer. And Anthony Fauci, who was always boxing with Larry, and was boxing with many people who saw him, and a lot of times, rightfully so, he was more, you know, he was working for the government, he's doing all this, and Larry, to a certain extent, realized there's something, right now, the government doesn't like gay people, not that concerned about this. And there all this, the push and the fight to get that. And Fauci makes a statement, he says, look, when I look at medicine, the history of medicine, there's medicine before Larry Kramer, and there's medicine after Larry Kramer. And I put that together with that comment about the world changed because of Larry. Let's talk about that.
Well, Anthony Fauci and Larry have a very interesting relationship. I have to say, Anthony Fauci really has a great deal of regard for Larry. When I first contacted him to do an interview for the film, you know, this guy's the head of the NIH. He got back to my email in 15 minutes. He said he would love to do it because he loves Larry. And I think Larry and Tony had such a personal connection, even though they were two men on complete opposite sides. And at first, you know, Larry calls him an incompetent idiot in print. Fauci has a pretty thick skin because he and Larry were able to talk and he understood that, first of all, Larry and he agreed on what needed to be done. The difference was Larry wanted Fauci to chain himself to the White House fence. And Fauci at a certain point said to him, Larry, okay, if I do that, I will get the front page of all the newspapers and no one will ever listen to me again. Is that really what you want me to do? And, you know, Kramer said, yeah. So they had different approaches, that's for sure. But the main thing that came out of it, and this is why he makes that comment of medicine before and after Kramer, is because what was truly unique was that this was the first time that the afflicted populations, the people who actually had AIDS, were helping set the protocols because it made sense. The medical establishment did not really understand the populations that were getting AIDS. Process of approval for the drugs was very, very slow, and people were not living very long, so there needed to be a way to expedite testing. And really what they're talking about is the drug testing process at that time was such that only certain people who were not sick or not yet manifesting certain symptoms could get access to these experimental trials. So really what happened, and this was ACT UP that came up with the idea, was there would be a parallel track, and these would be people who did not fit the description of the perfect trial participant. These were people who were sick and who were desperate, but that they would get the medicines on a compassionate basis, and that also there would be data that could be drawn in from these populations as well. So that's truly what was remarkable, was they really came up with a structure that could give us good science, the pure science that the NIH wanted, but also that could provide compassionate use, so that you had mutual benefits there. You had the community was benefiting by getting access to these experimental treatments, and you had the science still being served. So that was remarkable. And I do think that it's not too hyperbolic for Fauci to say that. And it makes sense. Why shouldn't the populations who are getting hardest hit have a voice in how these treatments are structured or how these trials are structured?
You went into this with a certain view and a relationship with Larry. And you walked through this, and I know that anyone who makes films, who writes stories, you change in the middle of it. You change in your perspective, you change in your understanding. When you come out of this, I can understand, like, actually very deeply what compelled you to make this film. But if you talk about that, what compelled you to make this film, but also, how were you different when you came out of it?
Well, one thing that happened during the making of it was that Larry got very sick. And at first, when I had to go into the hospital and shoot with him, I was really concerned that the documentary, instead of being about this fiery activist who was really out there and pushing boundaries, I was afraid it was going to be just documenting his death. And also, he was losing weight, and it was bringing back awful memories of the amount of friends who I had documented in the hospital back at the height of the AIDS epidemic. I just really didn't want to make this film about Larry dying. But what changed, it was that in the process of watching Larry, his resilience in the hospital bed, just seeing him, how there was the humor, the insight, and also the very shy, sweet man, that was all there. And watching Larry fight this very personal fight gave me new perspective on him, gave me a new appreciation of him, not just as a public figure, but as just a human being. Very, very strong human being who was in the middle of a fight for his life and who still managed to maintain his dignity, his creativity, his love, his friends. So I came out really with a new appreciation of Larry. And also I became closer with him during the making of it.
All right, Gene Carlomusto, a wonderful film. People got to see it.
Thank you so much.
Sure. All right, welcome back. That was my interview with Gene Carlomusto, the director of Larry Kramer in Love and Anger. And it's the portrait of one of the most important and controversial figures in contemporary gay America, and frankly, in contemporary world. Okay, someone who had the courage to stand up, tell the truth and fight for that and fight against all forms of oppression that he encountered. Gene Carlomusto is a producer, director, and editor who has produced documentaries and independent films for over 30 years, all right? And the film is currently running on HBO, so don't miss it. We're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we'll be listening to actor Keith David's reading of Frederick Douglass's mind-blowing speech, What to the Slave is Your 4th of July? So stay tuned. Thank you.
another psychopath in Iowa, loading up another round, while the NRA and Columbine put Marilyn Manson down. Powder in the Pentagon, crew letters in the mail, some KKK white supremacist cooking up a dose of race hate. I tell you now, I don't need no country, I don't fly no flag, I cut no slack for the Union Jack, stars and stripes got me jet black, yeah. I don't need no country, I don't fly no flag, I cut no slack for the Union Jack, stars and stripes got me jet black, yeah.
All right, welcome back. That was Alabama 3 with Woody Guthrie is the name of the song. Sometimes you find it called Flag, all right? And I play that because I think it actually captures some of the spirit that we need a whole hell of a lot more of in relation to all the stuff that's going on in the world right now. Don't need no country, don't need no flag, all right? Now, I wanted to introduce this because it was a very moving time last year, about this time, that Keith David, the actor Keith David, came in to do a reading from Frederick Douglass's speech given at a 4th of July celebration in 1852. Now, Frederick Douglass had been asked to deliver the speech, and it was called What to the Slave is Your 4th of July? Keith David does a reading of that speech. But just before we jump into listening to Keith David reading this speech, I wanted to let people know that if you want to download it for yourself, it will be available on SoundCloud as a standalone download. And you can go to soundcloud.com/Michael Slate. And you'll find the speech there, and you can download it and listen to it and spread it around as much as you want. So why don't I stop talking about it, and we'll just jump into listening to the segment I did last year with Keith David around Frederick Douglass's speech, What to the Slave is Your 4th of July? Well, I'm very pleased to be welcoming to the show my next guest. His name is Keith David. He's an actor of a really fine actor in both film and theater, and he recently completed a I don't know, how long was it, Keith? Weeks. Weeks and weeks and weeks of portraying Paul Robeson on stage. He's also, I understand, you're going to be playing Frederick Douglass in an upcoming film?
Yes.
Okay.
I am.
Well, welcome to the show, man. Welcome to the show. I'm really glad to have you here.
Thank you. I appreciate
it. Sure. And I wanted to let people know that this Frederick Douglass speech, a mutual friend of ours suggested to you and then said to me, hey, would you, you know, you always do this thing on Frederick Douglass, but would you be interested in having Keith read it? And she said that you were very, very pleased to be doing that. And I wanted to ask you just before you read it, What is the meaning of this? Why were you so moved by this speech from Frederick Douglass?
Well, I mean, Frederick Douglass and everything he stands for, stood for, today is as relevant as it was then. And that, to me, is shocking and amazing. But his insight into American politics, American policy, and his understanding of the Constitution and what it means to us and what it doesn't mean to us is just, it's profound. I mean, when you think about it, I mean, you know, what he says in this speech, as I said, is as relevant today as it was then. What amazes me is that he delivered this speech before a completely white audience, and nobody left. So they had to be listening to something, and it's not angry. It just is.
You know, one of the things that gets me too, though, is, and this is what I was thinking about when I was thinking about, do I want to do this speech again and have someone come in and read it? You know, I woke up one morning and I saw the headline that 3,000 people a week in Detroit are being denied water. And that's not just like random people. It's a concentration of black people in Detroit that are being denied water, you know, basic water. The statistic that all black males born now, between the ages of, you know, their birth and 13 now, can expect to spend some portion of their life in prison in this country. And then you look at what's going on, this ugly stuff that's going on with those anti-immigrant demonstrations by all those clannish type reactionaries against children out in Riverside, California.
Heard about that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, intense. And these children either being kept in prison in inhumane conditions or being sent back to places where death is really not like a, it's not like, oh, maybe yes, maybe no. There's actually a very good chance these kids will die, if not being killed directly, from the conditions that they're being forced to go back into. You know, it's a horrifying thing. And when I thought about this thing with Frederick Douglass, what it really raises to me is that the whole idea, you know, what he's calling out there is the fact that this country was then practicing dehumanization
and continues to this day to practice dehumanization.
And promises tomorrow to do the same thing.
Yeah, yeah. And what we need is to emancipate all humanity and stop this stuff. You know, so it's sort of, that's it. So why don't we jump into this?
Well, here we go. Fellow citizens, pardon me. Allow me to ask, why am I called upon here to speak today? What have I or those I represent to do with your national independence? Are the great principles of political freedom and of natural justice embodied in that Declaration of Independence extended to us? And am I therefore called upon to bring our humble offering to the national altar and to confess the benefits and express devout gratitude for the blessings resulting from your independence to us? Would to God, for both your sakes and ours, that an affirmative answer could be truthfully returned to these questions. Then would my task be light, and my burden easy and delightful. For who is there so cold that a nation's sympathy could not warm him? Who so obdurate and dead to the claims of gratitude that would not thankfully acknowledge such priceless benefits? Who so stolid and selfish that would not give his voice to swell the hallelujahs of a nation's jubilee when the chains of servitude had been torn from his limbs? I am not that man. In a case like that, the dumb might eloquently speak, and the lame man leap as an hart. But such is not the state of the case. I say it with a sad sense of the disparity between us. I am not included within the pale of this glorious anniversary. Your high independence only reveals the immeasurable distance between us. The blessings in which you this day rejoice are not enjoyed in common. The rich inheritance of justice, liberty, prosperity, and independence bequeathed by your fathers is shared by you, not by me. The sunlight that brought life and healing to you has brought stripes and death to me. This 4th of July is yours, not mine. You may rejoice. I must mourn. To drag a man in fetters into the grand illuminated temple of liberty and call upon him to join in your joyous anthems were inhuman mockery and sacrilegious irony. Do you mean, citizens, to mock me by asking me to speak today? If so, there is a parallel to your conduct, and let me warn you that it is dangerous to copy the example of a nation whose crimes, lowering up to heaven, were thrown down by the breath of the Almighty, burying that nation in irrecoverable ruin. I can today take up the plaintive lament of a peeled and woe-smitten people. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down. Yea, we wept when we remembered Zion. We hanged our harps upon the willows in the midst thereof. For there, they that carried us away captive required of us a song, and they who wasted us required of us mirth, saying, "Sing us one of the songs of Zion." How can we sing the Lord's song in a strange land? If I forget thee, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget her cunning. If I do not remember thee, let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth. Fellow citizens, above your national tumultuous joy, I hear the mournful wail of millions whose chains, heavy and grievous yesterday, are today rendered more intolerable by the jubilee shouts that reach them. If I do forget, if I do not faithfully remember those bleeding children of sorrow this day, may my right hand forget her cunning, and may my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth. To forget them, to pass lightly over their wrongs, and to chime in with the popular theme would be treason most scandalous and shocking, and would make me a reproach before God and the world. My subject, then, fellow citizens, is American slavery. I shall see this day and its popular characteristics from the slave's point of view. Standing there, identified with the American bondman making his wrongs mine, I do not hesitate to declare with all my soul that the character and conduct of this nation never looked blacker to me than on this 4th of July. Whether we turn to the declarations of the past or to the professions of the present, the conduct of the nation seems equally hideous and revolting. America is false to the past, false to the present, and solemnly binds herself to be false to the future. Standing with God and with the crushed and bleeding slave on this occasion, I will, in the name of humanity, which is outraged, in the name of liberty, which is fettered, in the name of the Constitution and the Bible, which are disregarded and trampled upon, dare to call in question and to denounce with all the emphasis I can command everything that serves to perpetuate slavery, the great sin and shame of America. I will not equivocate. I will not excuse. I will use the severest language I can command, and yet not one word shall escape me that any man whose judgment is not blinded by prejudice, or who is not at heart a slaveholder, shall not confess to be right and just. But I fancy I hear some of my audience say, it is just in this circumstance that you and your brother abolitionists fail to make a favorable impression on the public mind. Would you argue more and denounce less? Would you persuade more and rebuke less? Your cause would be much more likely to succeed. But I submit, where all is plain, there is nothing to be argued. What point in the anti-slavery creed would you have me argue? On what branch of the subject do the people of this country need light? Must I undertake to prove that the slave is a man? That point is conceded already. Nobody doubts it. The slaveholders themselves acknowledge it in the enactment of laws for their government. They acknowledge it when they punish disobedience on the part of the slave. There are 72 crimes in the state of Virginia which, if committed by a black man, no matter how ignorant he be, subject him to the punishment of death, while only 2 of the same crimes will subject a white man to the like punishment. What is this but the acknowledgement that the slave is a moral, intellectual, and responsible being? The manhood of the slave is conceded. It is admitted in the fact that Southern statute books are covered with enactments forbidding, under severe fines and penalties, the teaching of the slave to read or to write. When you can point to any such laws in reference to the beasts of the field, then may I consent to argue the manhood of the slave. When the dogs in your streets, when the fowls of the air, when the cattle on your hills, when the fish of the sea and the reptiles that crawl shall be unable to distinguish the slave from a brute, there will I argue with you that the slave is a man. For the present, it is enough to affirm the equal manhood of the Negro race. Is it not astonishing that while we are plowing and planting, reaping, using all kinds of mechanical tools, erecting houses, constructing bridges, building ships, working in metals of brass, iron, copper, silver, and gold, that while we are reading, writing, and ciphering, acting as clerks, merchants, and secretaries, having among us lawyers, doctors, ministers, poets, authors, editors, orators, and teachers, that while we are engaged in all manner of enterprises common to other men, digging in gold in California, capturing the whale in the Pacific, feeding sheep and cattle on the hillside, living, moving, acting, thinking, planning, living in families as husbands, wives, and children, and above all, confessing and worshiping the Christian's God and looking hopefully for life and immortality beyond the grave, we are called upon to prove that we are men. Would you have me argue that man is entitled to liberty? That he is the rightful owner of his own body? That you have already declared it. Must I argue the wrongfulness of slavery? Is that a question for Republicans? Is it to be settled by the rules of logic and argumentation as a matter beset with great difficulty involving a doubtful application of the principle of justice, hard to be understood? How should I look today in the presence of Americans, dividing and subdividing a discourse to show that men have a natural right to freedom, speaking of it relatively and positively, negatively and affirmatively? To do so would be to make myself ridiculous and to offer an insult to your understanding. There is not a man beneath the canopy of heaven that does not know that slavery is wrong for him. What, am I to argue that it is wrong to make men brutes? To rob them of their liberty? To work them without wages? To keep them ignorant of their relations to their fellow men? To beat them with sticks? To flay their flesh with the lash? To load their limbs with irons? To hunt them with dogs? To sell them at auction? To sunder their families? To knock out their teeth? To burn their flesh, to starve them into obedience and submission to their masters. Must I argue that a system thus marked with blood and stained with pollution is wrong? No, I will not. I have better employments for my time and strength than such arguments would imply. What then remains to be argued? Is it that slavery is not divine, that God did not establish it, that our doctors of divinity are mistaken? There is blasphemy in the thought. That which is inhuman cannot be divine. Who can reason on such a proposition? They that can may, I cannot. The time for such argument is past. At a time like this, scorching irony, not convincing argument, is needed. Oh, had I the ability and could reach the nation's ear, I would today pour out a fiery stream of biting ridicule, blasting reproach, withering sarcasm, and stern rebuke. For it is not light that is needed, but fire. It is not the gentle shower, but thunder. We need the storm, the whirlwind, and the earthquake. The feeling of the nation must be quickened. The conscience of the nation must be roused. The propriety of the nation must be startled. The hypocrisy of the nation must be exposed. And its crimes against God and man must be proclaimed and denounced. What to the American slave is your 4th of July? I answer, a day that reveals to him more than all other days in the year the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is a constant victim. To him, your celebration is a sham, your boasted liberty an unholy license, your national greatness swelling vanity. Your sounds of rejoicing are empty and heartless, your denunciation of tyrants' brass-fronted impudence, your shouts of liberty and equality, hollow mockery. Your prayers and hymns, your sermons and thanksgivings, with all your religious parade and solemnity, are to him mere bombast, fraud, deception, impiety, and hypocrisy. A thin veil to cover up crimes which would disgrace a nation of savages. There is not a nation on earth guilty of practices more shocking and bloody than are the people of these United States at this very hour. Go where you may, search where you will, roam through all the monarchies and despotisms of the old world, travel through South America, search out every abuse, and when you have found the last, lay your facts by the side of the everyday practices of this nation, and you will say with me that for revolting barbarity and shameless hypocrisy, America reigns without a rival.
Keith David, just incredible. Just very powerful. I'm not going to even try to say anything more after that, brother. That was just remarkable. Thank you very much for joining us today.
I greatly appreciate the opportunity.
And to tell you the truth, I can't think of anything more appropriate than to follow up that reading of Frederick Douglass's speech, What to the Slave is Your Fourth of July, with this excerpt from the dialogue between Cornel West and Bob Avakian. And that dialogue is Revolution and Religion, the Fight for Emancipation and the Role of Religion, a dialogue between Cornel West and Bob Avakian. And you can watch that online at www.revcom.us/film. Again, that's www.revcom.us/film. But let's just jump right into this. What if the world could be a whole different way? And this is Bob Avakian.
And many people say, we need religion to be able to endure, to survive, to keep from going crazy, to continue to struggle on, even to have some moments of joy and glimmers of hope in a world full of so much cruelty and brutality, heartbreak and heartlessness. But what if the world doesn't have to be this way? What if we could live in a world where never again would a parent have to fear for the life of their child just because of the color of their skin? What if we lived in a world where never again would that soul-wrenching experience that never leaves of having to bury your own child whose life was stolen by a brutal thug with a gun and the backing of the powers that be? What if being black no longer meant living in a white supremacist society that continually assaults you in your very being and very sense of worth, constantly subjects you to terror, openly or in more subtle ways, and forces you to face the constant danger that you or your children will have your life snuffed out at any moment for doing nothing but being? What if your humanity really mattered and were considered precious? What if this were true of all people of color and of immigrants? What in fact, if all people were just people of different colors, and there were no distinctions and discrimination and persecution and brutality based on what nationality or race you were? What if there were no such thing as immigrants? What if we all lived in a world community of human beings without borders and tanks and guns and planes to enforce them?
yes, yes.
What if women could walk down the street and look every man they encounter straight in the eye and fear nothing and not be made to feel? And not be made to feel that you're on display and to be evaluated by how you sexually titillate them. What if no more women were ever again battered, raped, assaulted, denied the right to control their own bodies?
That's right. That's right.
What if people who were different in their sexual orientation or just in the way they went through life, instead of being discriminated against and bullied, were valued for their difference? If that were seen as part of the great diversity of humanity? What if there were no more one part of society exploiting the others, and those exploited had no choice but to enrich them in order to be able to live themselves, working their whole life away under conditions of this ruthless exploitation? What if we didn't have to live in a lopsided world where a small number in a small number of countries have accumulate tremendous wealth by exploiting the great majority, and the conditions of the great majority are desperate? Look at the world. Look at the phenomenon of Ebola. There's been a lot of concern about Ebola, rightly so, but way too much hysterical fear about whether a few people here might get Ebola, and not nearly enough concern about what is happening to the people in Africa.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely.
What if there were no more wars for domination and plunder? What if there were whole different relations among people, valuing each other's humanity? What if there were different relations to the environment, protecting it and providing for future generations instead of despoiling and ruining it? What if we could have a whole different outlook on life and on the future instead of one of dread and one of desperately striving just to make it? Now, to paraphrase John Lennon's song, Imagine, you may say I'm a dreamer, but this is not just a dream. It is something for which there is a definite basis in reality, and it is up to us, together with people throughout the world, to make it a reality.
Once again, that was Bob Avakian, and it was taken from the dialogue he had with Cornel West, and you can listen to that whole dialogue at www.revcom.us/film. You've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm the host and producer, Michael Slate. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my board offer today, Federico Garcia. I also want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. And now we just got to run out. No music, nothing else except goodbye. Talk to you again next week.